You're listening to Dr. Tony Nader, the podcast, dedicated to exploring the full potential of human physiology and mind, with focus on ancient and modern techniques of self-development. Spend some time with Dr. Nader, who is leading the way in the science of consciousness, and begin your journey to better understanding the relationship of mind and body, consciousness, and physiology right now.
Namaste, Jai Hind, and welcome to a very, very special conversation, ladies and gentlemen. Who am I is a question that every human being passes through their minds sometime or the other. The other aspect is, how can I rise to a higher level of consciousness? Now, we're sitting in, perhaps in the presence of somebody who's made it his life's karma and dharma to take humanity to a higher level of consciousness. Dr. Tony Nader, namaste, and thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Namaste. Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I hope the introduction has been apt, because it's such a long list that if I were to start introducing the work that you've done as a scientist and also as a spiritual leader, I will perhaps use a bulk of the interview time. So let me first ask you, sir, transcendental meditation, is it science or is it spirituality?
It is both, in the sense that it makes spirituality a science. The ability to use the mind and consciousness and show that they influence our behavior, our health, our well-being in a scientific way makes it a science. What is a science is what is reliable, systematic, and repeatable. Transcendental meditation is a very systematic, simple technique that even children can learn, and it is taught in a very systematic way. It is reliable because every time we use it, we have the results, and it's repeatable, so you don't have the result just once, but throughout the time, it has been shown to produce the effects that it does, and that has been proven with hundreds of scientific research studies that have been peer-reviewed and published in scientific journals.
You are a neuroscientist yourself. So when you came in contact with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he was bringing the concept of Vedic scriptures and the science of the Vedas to the West, were you a skeptic? Did you first look at it and say, really?
I was a skeptic. I have to be a skeptic as a scientist, because if you don't ask questions, that means you are in a belief system. And this system is not a belief system. You don't have to believe in it for it to work. And so when I looked at the research studies, and particularly when I tried it myself and have seen the effects on my friends and family and others, I found that it is so reliable that the skepticism went away and assuredness of the results came along.
So when did you dive into the science of it? Because it's been many, many years. And since 2008, you've been leading the entire transcendental meditation drive right through the world. So at what point did you really realize that humanity needs to understand that this is not bunkum, there is some science behind it?
Well, the science of it came in layers, in ways. At the beginning, just the effectiveness of the technique, that it actually does what it promises. And this I've looked at even before I started, because I didn't want to spend time on something that wastes my time. So I looked at the research, studied it, and found that it's convincing, so I tried it myself. Now, another layer of that is the understanding that comes from the Vedic literature, from Vedanta, from the primacy of consciousness, and that is a higher level where it's no more the understanding of some technique that works, but also what is the ultimate reality of life, how consciousness plays in, what is spirituality, and all of this required much more convincing and congruent, if you like, levels of scientific understanding, even philosophical considerations. And that is where I went deeply into consciousness and its effects from a scientific point of view.
This quest for a higher consciousness, this seems to be driving a lot of people somewhere or the other. Some of them are conscious about this quest, some of them are not. What you endeavor to do in Hyderabad is something phenomenal. 10,000 people from, what, 120 countries?
Yeah. Or is it more? Actually, today I was told we have 134 countries.
Wow.
So people got inspired and more are coming and joining.
Are they coming on their own?
Yeah, they are on their own.
And what do you endeavor to do in Hyderabad?
We endeavor to actually practice transcendental meditation and its advanced techniques, which we call the Siddhi program. Siddhi is a term from Sanskrit that means perfection, and that is perfection in thought. It comes from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and Maharishi has demonstrated and explained how it works. So he brought to light the technology of consciousness. Transcending is to go beyond the surface level. Suppose the mind or consciousness is like an ocean, and we are on the surface level, on the waves level. To dive deep into the ocean is to transcend the surface values and go to the bottom of the ocean and actually realize that we are the ocean. That's the discovery of the self. The advanced techniques of that, which is called the Siddhi program, is how to think from that level and how actually to create an effect on the surface from the bottom of the ocean. So what these 10,000 people from 134 countries are going to do is transcend and experience that field and act from that field. Act meaning on the thought level, enliven that field of consciousness. And what we have seen is when a small number of people, a small percentage of a population, practices this technique together, it enlivens what we call the collective consciousness.
I believe you've done some magic in Australia. They've named an act after what you've taught them. Is that true?
I'm not aware. Maybe you remind me.
I'm told that in Australia, because of practicing transcendental meditation, they have now dedicated the entire act itself towards this because it reduced violence, it reduced a certain level of crime. But you said that even accidents, even rash driving, what does it scientifically do? Because you're a neuroscientist. So if you can explain to our viewers, what does it do? I'm told even with American soldiers, PTSD is something which they're being taught to counter and deal with practicing transcendental meditation. So what does it scientifically do?
So there is an effect on the individual, and that is very clear what it does. It creates greater brain coherence. So the brain is made out of many processors, each one analyzing different aspects of our life.
Just one a computer for seeing, in itself.
Right, exactly. One for seeing, one for hearing, one for touching, one for feeling, one for intuition, calculating, experiencing, creative thinking. All of these are different parts of the brain. And if they work together, it means they analyze the situation in a much more complete way. And that's why we have seen that people who practice transcendental meditation on an individual level, they have more creativity, more intelligence, more ability to be happy and fulfilled and achieve their goals in life. Now, the way it does it is, again, by transcending, which means going deeper in the ocean of the mind. And as you go deeper in the ocean, like the ocean, the mind settles down. And when it settles down, it becomes more and more quiet. Since mind and body are intimately connected, when the mind settles down, the body also rests very deeply. That deep rest allows the body to release the deep-rooted stresses and strains that are there and wipes away wrong memories. And this is how it helps in PTSD. It helps in anxiety, depression, but also improves health at the physical level because the body gets more integrated and start functioning in a more complete way. So this is on the individual level, greater brain coherence, the brain works together, and that creates an effect on the individual. Now, there is a new science called the collective neuroscience,
yes,
which in recent years, even just these past 2-3 years, have shown that when two people are together and thinking along the same line or even discussing a topic, that their brains get coherent, which means not only within one brain there is coherence, but between my brain and the brain of the person like your brain now, probably because we're thinking together, there is some kind of coherence that settles in.
True. You've actually taken the concept of airdropping data from one phone to the other to saying sharing data from one human being to the other in terms of neural waves. But there are also those people who know the need for consciousness for world peace, because collectively this is going to bring down world peace, and I think that's one of your targets. But those very people are also conscious about the business of war and conflict. So these are at opposite ends of each other. How do you resolve that?
Well, those who are looking for example, political gain or for economic gain through war, they think that this is the only way to get their goals. So we don't tell them that they will lose their gains. Actually, we are giving them a better way to achieve their goals. Because ultimately in war, everyone loses. Of course, there are some who sell arms and all that.
The arms lobby
and
wins.
Yeah, exactly. And
the military-industrial complexes, they are the ones who profit.
Right. They think they are making money. But this profit is time-restricted. Ultimately, if there is fear in society, there is stress in society, they might make a little more money or a lot more money. But they're living in an environment that is stressful, that is tense, that is fearful, and that can influence their personal life one way or the other. So what we're saying is by creating a coherent group, even the economic goals and the political goals will be achieved in a better way, in a more holistic way, that are more sustainable throughout time, and for a larger number of people.
But there is a significant group, the influential group, that has the quest for control. So quest for control, again, is in conflict with quest for consciousness, because consciousness means I live, you live, you live, so I live. That's how it is. But when it's the quest for control, you have to live the way I tell you to live. So that's where it is.
See, the quest for control is not an aim and an end in itself. The end of it is to secure your own protection, to secure your own values, to be happy, to feel confident, to make a life that is worth living. And you think that you can do it by controlling others. This is one mechanism. So when I control, I can do whatever I want, therefore I'll be happy, and my values and my wealth and my well-being are protected. Now, this is only a fictitious level of reality, because you can control for some time some people. You cannot control for all time all the people.
Yeah, true.
And therefore, you're going to have to want more control. And when you look through history, you find that there were like great people who think they are great because they want to unify the world on the basis of, you know, eliminating differences and becoming, you know, control the whole world. Alexander and all of these, you know, invaders and even Napoleon and whatever. Everyone, and they might do it with great desire. I mean, in their mind, they're doing the right thing because they are imposing unity and all of that. It never works. It never works because life is always growing, is always demonstrating differences and variety, and new qualities are emerging all the time in evolution. And therefore, you have to allow evolution to take its course, and you cannot control from a certain perspective. So what you can do is nourish the value of life, of consciousness, that underlies all of the differences in life, and allow the differences to grow, and let all the values interact together to produce a much higher and richer level of life.
You've chosen Hyderabad for this massive exercise. Why?
First, this knowledge that we have about the technology of transcending comes from Bharat. It comes from the Vedic tradition. It has been taught in the West by Indian Bharati, great Rishi, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And we have been teaching a lot in India. We have taught a lot in the West at the beginning, but it has now come back also to India as a science, as a science of life. And India is open to science now, as much as to spirituality. Of course, it was based on the highest spirituality. But now that spirituality is also scientific, then there is an openness to that. And so it's an opportunity to create this effect from the land of the Veda, from the land from which it emerged, And particularly because our great hope is that this will become permanent, that it's not going to be just a demonstration. You know, you turn the light on, everybody sees and feels good, but you turn the light off and you have to expect things going back to where they were. And that's what we are most concerned about, is that we can create an effect, but what we want is this effect to be permanent. And today, India has the highest likelihood of actually maintaining this effect. I have been and had the honor and pleasure to be in touch with many great spiritual leaders in India, and they are joining us, many of them. They have sent some of their representatives and disciples, and they want to practice this technique of transcending and see the effect, and they are promising and they are looking forward to maintain it permanently. So there is a great hope, not only for 2 weeks, but hopefully for all time.
All time. Do you see Bharat as a nation rising in consciousness? We are a nation of 1.4 billion people, so out of an 8 billion population, a 1.4 billion would rise in consciousness. It'll have a spillover effect on the rest of the world. But do you see that happening? You've been watching and you've been coming to Bharat for quite some time, many years now.
I see it happening very strongly, absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Because of the number of people who are more and more practicing transcendental meditation. And the role Bharat is playing now in the world, which is very pacifying, very harmonious, very balanced, very coherent, very wise. And it has the knowledge of consciousness, which the whole world is adapting now. You know, you go in the West now, you don't see anyone who doesn't talk about meditation and yoga and Ayurveda. And so, as is beautifully said in India, Satyameva Jayate, and therefore Sattva is triumphing. And since India has those beautiful concepts of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, the world is my family, that consciousness is primary, the Vedantic understanding, and the openness to all culture, all belief, just looking at the ocean and, you know, making sure all the waves are healthy, no matter how many different ways they are. India is absolutely a fabulous place, Bharat.
Ram, Shiva, Shakti, Krishna, these are household names across the length and breadth of the country. Many people say these are all myths, you know, story, folktale. But would you believe there is a reason why only these names are household names?
Well, I have learned from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi these names in terms of their natural law function and their reality. For example, Maharishi explains Shiva as silence, pure silence, explains Vishnu as dynamism, infinite dynamism. Shakti is the energy, the power. So these are different names that have been given to different manifestations of consciousness. The one consciousness, one unbounded ocean of being, one unbounded ocean of consciousness, manifests itself into all that there is. And there is a manifestation at the deepest level. One is silence, total silence. So we call it Shiva. One is its dynamism, its ability to move, its ability to reflect and dynamically create. That is maintenance value, dynamism of Vishnu. The creative value, Brahma. So you have these values that are actually laws of nature that are fundamental, and then you have more and more expressed values.
The potencies.
Exactly, but all are actually one. When I look at Hinduism and the Indian culture and Vedic culture, people say it's a polytheist kind of belief system and cultural system, which is true in some way, of course, but ultimately for me it is completely based on one consciousness, one field of being. And Krishna says it beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita, that all the offerings that you do to the gods and to do this, it is offering to me. So it is that one reality which underlies all the differences. The beauty, though, is that everything is divine in India, because everything is the expression of natural law. Everything is expression of one consciousness. So there is one consciousness that expresses itself into multitudes of levels. And so in that way, everything is divine. Everything is an expression of the divine. And this value, Aham Brahmasmi, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahm, is a reality on a scientific level.
On a scientific level. You said Patram Pushpam Phalam Toyam Yome Bhakta Prayachati. That's what in the Bhagavad Gita, where he also says, Mai Sarvam Idam Proktam Sutre Manigana Iva. I am the thread.
Beautiful.
Which you don't see.
Beautiful.
Which is strung together. So, coming to the last two or three questions, what should India do? What should every Bharatiya do? Is transcendental meditation, should it be taught in schools? I know a lot of schools are teaching it, but should it be taught scientifically? Because the current generation does not want to just say, breathe in, breathe out. They want to know, why should I breathe in and why should I breathe out? What's it going to do to my space between the ears? You think it should be made a subject? It should be
absolutely part of
the educational curriculum?
Maharishi said, and now scientifically also we can say, that every young person should start by learning how to know themselves, and know themselves to be their true inner Brahman, Brahmasmi, Aham Brahmasmi. And by knowing that, then they are establishing themselves on a platform of knowing themselves and knowing how to behave from that infinite field of creativity and intelligence which is within them, rather than knowing themselves as limited perspective. You know, people, as they come to school and they come to life, they are told things. You are your name, this is your value, this is this, and then you are good at this, you're not good at that, you are this, you are that, and they form a sense of the self which is very restricted, very limited. And that limits their potentiality and limits their ability to see wholeness. If they are from the beginning knowing themselves to be infinite, unbounded, unlimited, pure being, pure consciousness, then the other aspects build up on a platform of wholeness, and their behavior towards the others, their creativity, their assuredness, their self-understanding, their self-love is growing, and they live an enlightened, a liberated life.
Is PM Narendra Modi driving Bharat in the right direction?
I love what he's doing, of course, yes. I'm not in politics, but
not the political aspect.
Yeah,
I'm just saying as a nation building.
I admire the direction that Modiji is taking, because he's open, he's scientific in many ways. He has been inspiring for the whole world to be together, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, and to use that perfect, beautiful knowledge as a science. You know, I have had discussions with great even imams in India, and they are open to the Veda as a science of life.
One of the conflicts is, like you said, accepting it as a science. So if I have to sit, just like before the interview, you were just focusing internally. I know you've had a long day before chatting with me. I also do it. So when I have to breathe in and breathe out, I will not chant Om because it's Hindu. So what should I chant? So, you know, these are questions which come. You are making me chant Om because you want to wean me away from my current faith and you want me to become a Hindu. So what should such people do? What should they focus on when they have to really start? The first step is to get your breathing right. I'm saying the first baby step towards transcendental meditation, and that's where the biggest hurdle is, saying who do I think about and what should I think about?
Well, there are different layers in yoga. You know, in the Ashtanga yoga, there are the eight limbs, and the eight limbs have been assumed to be steps in progression. So yam, niyam, asanas, pranayam, pratyahara, dhara, natyan, samadhi. And it was felt like you have to start here and then build up and then build up, and then even the breathing and all of that. What Maharishi has taught us is that the eight are like limbs that grow together. So if you have four legs of a table or a chair, you pull one and all of them come together along. So why not go to the highest, to samadhi? And so that is why the first thing we teach and we inspire to teach is to transcend. Transcend is go to samadhi. Samadhi, the evenness of the mind, the evenness of the intellect, which is the field of going beyond the surface value. And that is not requiring any belief in anything, or even the mantras that we use. They have no meaning. We teach them as completely meaningless, and it's important that we don't even actually have a mantra that has a meaning in order to be able to transcend it.
Yeah,
so the mantra is only a vehicle that allows the mind to transcend, guided by its own nature to go towards more. And the mantra is there to help you stay awake in a non-directed way. If the mantra had a specific meaning, it will already focus you on some level of specific value. So that specific value, be it religious or supreme value, or be it mundane value, because when we taught transcendental meditation, some scientists thought, oh, it's great, let's use any word. So they started to use the word one or some other thing. But it didn't lead to the results at all, because these mantras come from the ancient tradition, and it's really experimental. You don't have to believe in it. You don't have to believe in the mantra having any meaning or any significant religious value. It's just transcending into yourself, and the mantra is just a vehicle that guides you there.
See, so there's a lot of research that's gone behind it, and that's why the rishis who did a lot of research and the munis who did a lot of thinking, and then they evolved this practice, which is actually irreligious. Thank you so much, Dr. Nehra. I could continue having this conversation, but time is of essence. Always a pleasure to speak with people like you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Namaste. The pleasure was mine. You're amazing and sharp. It's great to be
with
you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into Dr. Tony Nader, the podcast. And if you're interested in learning more from Dr. Nader, please follow him on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.